listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This is day one. My name is John Wildman. I am the editor of Festworks.com, and we are on location in Park City, Utah, at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from the historic Main Street, where we'll be for the next 10 days interviewing some of the most important voices in the independent film world. Our Daily Buzz studio is right in the center of all the festival action during the day at PC Live and is a home of Chef Dance at night. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts, Kim Voyner of WonderTech Labs, Minji Chang of Collaboration, and Lanzia Wan. Today, we are going to be talking about hot topics with Eric Childress of WGN and Kim Haywood of Dead Center Film Festival. The Sundance Spotlight film, Sammy Blood, and documentaries, Look and See, A Portrait of Wendell Berry, Motherland, and Dina. We are going to be talking about a lot of films. I mean, we have a packed schedule, and we're going to start off right now with our hot topics with Eric Childress of WGN and Kim Haywood of Dead Center. How are you guys?
Hello.
Great.
Good morning.
Okay, so we're on day one. Well, I mean, this is like the real first day, right? We had the first opening. Did you guys catch some of the opening films last night?
Saw an Inconvenient sequel.
Okay.
Which is great. Definitely left me feeling alive and like there's hope yet, which is what I wanted.
Is it hopeful?
I'm sorry?
Is it hopeful?
It is. I think more so than the first film. I felt I walked out feeling more hopeful globally speaking.
Okay. Good to know.
It's hard to believe it's been a decade.
Right?
Since I was, when I saw it on the schedule this year, I was like, I can't believe it's been a whole decade since I saw An Inconvenient Truth the first time. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that it's hopeful. I didn't catch it last night. I don't feel very hopeful about the environment myself right now. So.
Well, and after the first film, who knew that we were going to be here for 10 more years? So.
Well, I mean, it's hopeful to the extent that there are more people clearly aware of the problem and the people that Al Gore is clearly inspired to work the problem, basically. It's a little less hopeful when you get to towards the end of the movie and they show you 2 days after the current election and everything that seemed hopeful up to that point seemed completely down the rabbit hole. But I didn't think the movie was great for this reason and that. I mean, the first movie was sort of like this, you know, this great PowerPoint, you know, presentation that got the message out and the content was really necessary. This movie starts off with, I think, the promise of perhaps calling out the people who were the naysayers and continue to be naysayers over the last few years. It has these voices of like Sean Hannity and Fox News, all the senators who said bad things, and you think it's going to be this giant "I told you so" to these people, and instead it kind of veers away from that too often. I thought that they could have, you know, like show like a really stupid statement and then go like, no, look, this is happening, these are facts, this is fake news.
So it muted the impact of it.
It did. I thought that going, you know, what are we going to learn? Is it going to be an update film, what we had from 10 years ago? And this movie, in some ways, I've heard it described as sort of a victory lap for Al Gore, and that it was nice to see him have this mad passion at times where he would actually be yelling and, you know, screaming his thoughts. I'm like, that's the attitude that might have got you elected in 2000 if you would have shown a little bit more of that.
They kept calling Mr. President.
Yeah, like,
Mr. President. I was never the president.
There are a couple of nice Florida digs in there and whatnot, and it's just it doesn't seem very substantial to me. It's nice to see that this is happening, but it doesn't play. It's only going to play to the base.
Okay, I saw I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, Macon Blair's directorial debut, which Macon Blair, of course, is a star of Blue Ruin and also was in Green Room, Jeremy Saulnier's movie. This film falls right in line with those films, and with the ink black comedy. As it is, a lot of violence, a lot of awkward humor. Elijah Wood is again delivers another very eccentric, very quirky performance, very cool one. And I also thought that what was interesting is because, you know, it falls right in that, you know, that you could make a wonderful box set of those three films. There were some refined touches that weren't in those other films. And so you go, huh, okay, so Macon behind the camera really showing off the stuff. It was really good. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet. The other film I saw last night was called The Little Hours. Jeff Baena, who was here last year, did a film called Joshi, and he's got another really great cast. Basically did one of the stories of the Decameron is like this sort of like this sex comedy farce that just doesn't work in the slightest. I mean, it's, if you remember the movie Your Highness that David Gordon Green did a few years ago, you don't want to remember that. I'm sorry to even bring it up. But it's much closer to that than I think the what he was going for with this sort of this not-so-sophisticated sex comedy.
Okay. Let's talk about some stuff that's kind of in the news right now. I wanted to get your guys' opinion on the Amazon 100K deal. What have you guys heard about this? What do you think about this offer that Amazon offering for films that they pick up $100,000 on top of whatever the deal is to give them exclusivity and to basically try to run the table and sweep all the films away?
You know, there's a lot of talk as a festival programmer about VOD and films not going theatrical and going online immediately, and it's sort of two approaches for me. One, I think it's absolutely wonderful for filmmakers, especially documentary filmmakers, whereas, you know, they were doing this festival circuit and they wouldn't get distribution or you wouldn't really see the film. I think it's awesome for them. From a festival approach, Amazon, Netflix makes it a little bit more difficult for us.
Yes, it does.
Very much so. So I think we're all talking, and last night we were talking with some other festival people about how we navigate this and what we do. And I don't think there's an answer yet. We kind of have to feel it out and see what's happening. So again, it's difficult on our end, but I'm thrilled for filmmakers who have, you know, these offers from these streaming companies to get their film out into the world.
Is this 100K thing an online only deal? Because Amazon is doing theatrical, of course, as well. They have quite a few contenders in the Oscar race.
Yeah, I have to be frank. I'm a little fuzzy on it, and it just sounds like one of those things of like throwing the gauntlet down, going, you know, if we want to take all the movies, and you know, and we've got a checkbook.
I really hope we can get Ted Hope on later this week, and maybe he can enlighten us a little more about that. I know since Ted took the helm at Amazon Studios, he absolutely had a plan for what he intended to do there. And, of course, he's always been a wonderful supporter of independent filmmakers. So if we get him on the show later this week, we'll have to make sure to discuss that.
Because, honestly, it sounded like from on the surface of it, it sounded a little bit like Mr. Potter and It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Pottersville, wrong Pottersville now.
Take 100K, George. Don't be stupid, George Bailey. Take the 100K right now.
Well, it does seem like, you know, like especially after the year that Amazon had, and they're really sort of their first really big year on the festival circuit, that they're really sort of feeling like their own mandate. Like they have the momentum right now, and they feel like they can push this forward. As someone who programs my own film festival, Chicago Critics Film Festival, and our primary goal is just to get films seen. You know, we're bringing films from festivals all across the world to Chicago, so people who can't get out to Sundance and South By and Toronto and Cannes and all these things. And I just hope that any deal, because you said the word exclusivity, that to me sounds like, well, we're going to control everything.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
We're whatever profits, you know, and it's great that filmmakers want to make profit and everything, but you want to make sure the films get seen. And when I hear the word exclusivity, I cringe a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I want to talk really quickly about VOD. And, you know, I started thinking on festworks.com, which I write down the last 10 films I watched, and I write how I watched them, like DVD or VOD or theatrical, just to try to encourage people to see, well, how are we watching movies? And, my film, The Ladies of the House, went straight to VOD, and Eric, I'd really like to hear you weigh in this on, you know, how you write about it, you know, because, you know, it seems to me we are watching movies more and more on VOD, and yet they're not really reviewed off of VOD. You know, they're reviewed theatrically, but films that go straight to VOD, that, you know, it's like the press is lagging behind.
People are taking their entertainment with them where they go, but the press hasn't yet caught up to that. In the same way that the press, when blogging first became a thing, bloggers were like low man on the totem pole. Oh, he's just a blogger. And then blogs became the predominant voice of festivals.
Exactly. Eric, what do you think about this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, because considering as a member of the press, I think we get as many streaming links to things, especially a lot of VOD stuff, prior to, you know, getting a chance before they come out. So I think we probably see as many streaming links a year as we do screenings and theatrical events. So it's interesting to me that, you know, because when I get something, a VOD release that I don't care for, I'm not going to review it. You know, I don't feel the need to, you know, sort of trounce on something have that kind of thing. I always say at festivals, like, you make it hard for me to see the movie, I'm going to review it whether it's positive or negative. You make it easy, I will be very kind to you.
Yeah.
Yes.
But do you find that your outlets are as interested in reviews of streaming and VOD content as they are of first release.
Well, we used to do a segment on WGN Radio where we actually reviewed the new VOD releases every week, and good or bad for an extent, and then it just became too hard to keep track of everything that we kind of stopped doing, and we only focus on something that we really like that shows up on VOD.
And Kim, from the film festival perspective, you know, I've often told people that you know, film festivals are such a key seeding of the audiences for films.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So festivals, you know, for filmmakers, it's a chance to get your film in front of people and to grow an audience. And for a lot of films, you know, if they're showing at a film festival, that film's not necessarily finished. Like, they're still waiting for distribution. They're looking for audience reactions. They're making small edits. And so I do think that there's a great pool of filmmakers who are still interested in the festival circuit and understand the value to that. And then again, there are those filmmakers who want to go straight to VOD, and that's great. But, you know, we also have, you know, movie-going audiences that were there to support with these films. And so I'm glad to see, I think festivals are growing and people are getting behind them, and I'm glad that filmmakers are still participating in them.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up our Hot Topics. Again, we had Eric Childress from WGN and Kim Haywood from the wonderful Dead Center Film Festival. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're back on the Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. And again, I'm the editor of Festworks.com. And on this segment, we're going to be talking about the film Sammy Blood with Amanda Chanel. Did I say that right? I was practicing for just a couple moments for that. And this film is playing in the spotlight section from Sweden. And, you know, Amanda, you know, people that are listening to this may have not seen this film, may have not read about it. Tell us really quickly about the film, and then we'll launch into chatting about this movie.
Okay, I'll do my best. Well, it's about a 14-year-old girl. She's called Ella Maria, and she goes to Sami boarding school for indigenous reindeer herding children in the 1930s in Sweden, where only Swedish language is allowed. She decides to take off and get another life and become someone else and become Swedish.
Now this is framed. She's looking back on her experience. The woman that she's become many, many years later, as she's very close to her sister growing up. But of course, they have problems because she wants to escape and not be saddled, so to speak, with being in Lapland and what have you. I think that this is a film that is universal for so many cultures, so many countries. And why did it speak to you? Because I think it clearly did. This is a very intimate and a very emotional look at a people that culturally are very withdrawn. There is just a wall. And so for you to be able to get in there as you did as a director, I thought was exceptional. So
okay, yeah. Well, you know, I'm from a Sami family, so this is this story comes from my own family. So I grew up with thinking about this, and there are elders in my family who strongly reject Sami people. They speak quite badly about them, but I always known that they are Sami themselves. And when they were children, they grew up in reindeer herding, moving with the reindeer, and they spoke only Sami language as kids. But now they have another name and another identity, and we can't talk about the past. And then there's this other side of my family who are still in reindeer herding, where tradition and culture and language is very important. So, and those two sides can't meet anymore. So I grew up with both.
So there's still a conflict there.
Yes.
And oftentimes we'll have a film that will, like this one, that, you know, screens internationally, and, you know, and you're going to this country, you're going to Canada, you're going to, you know, England, you're going to European countries, and that don't share that culture, they're not that familiar with that, the reactions, you know, even though there's a universal aspect to it, are different. Has this film screened prior? Because it's in the spotlight section.
Yes, it's premiered at Venice, where it was awarded with two awards, Best European Film, Europa Cinema's label, and another award for Best First Time Director from the critics.
I'm curious as to how the audience has reacted.
Actually, they've reacted In many ways, well, in the same way, I think. I've been to screenings in Venice, and then it was in Toronto in the Discovery section, and then in Tokyo where it was awarded. And it was awarded in Thessaloniki and Sao Paulo, where I couldn't go. And, well, I think many people come up to me and say that they, that this is a film about them and that they recognize themselves. And they can be from all over. So, and I didn't really think about that making it. For me, it was a very personal film about a culture that I grew up in many ways, even though I didn't grow up in the 1930s, but still I grew up with language and the way of singing and these conflicts and this shame and this silence.
Right.
But yeah, I've received a lot of emails, people telling me like, I'm not who I say I am. Actually, I'm somewhere else from an, I'm another person from another country, and I've changed my name.
Wow.
So
wow.
I guess there are many Elle Maria.
Well, now,
there.
Yeah, because this was so personal, you know, how have you, has your family seen the film?
Some of them.
And what was the reaction?
Good so far. They've been really supportive, actually. But the Swedish premiere is in a week. It's nominated for Best Nordic Film and can win a million Swedish crowns. So I think they'll come to the Swedish premieres.
Okay, we'll be cheering you from afar.
Yeah.
For that.
Well, you know, it's a bit, you know, it's a wound. So, but I think that I'm picking in kind of, and but I think that's an artist's job.
Well, let's talk about making the movie and the lead actress. Remind me her name.
Lena Cecilia Sparrock. That's her real name.
She does wonderfully in this role, and in a lot of ways she has to carry this movie. Can you talk about, you know, working with her and, you know, and kind of, and supporting her through that process?
Yeah, actually she acts together with her little sister, which is a real little sister, so maybe that makes it easier in some ways. We were also very irritated working together, but well, I wanted two girls, and I wanted them to be able to speak South Sami language. There are only 500 fluent speakers today. I read it in school, but I'm not a fluent speaker, so it's one of the most endangered language according to the UN. And I wanted them to be in reindeer herding, preferably, because I wanted these tough girls who can survive anything.
Right.
And knows how to
they
handle...
Didn't look like, so they wouldn't look like an actress playing this, but they actually yeah. looked authentic.
Yeah, yes. And they know how to handle a knife.
Yes.
There's a lot of scenes with knives.
Yes. There are some scenes with knives.
Yeah. And handle the reindeer, of course, which can be quite frightening if you're not used to it. And then I found them. I started 2 years before shooting. And I think I've met all teenage girls speaking this language. Of course, we're related, so some are my cousins, but they're not my cousins.
That helps. That helps.
Yeah. No, but then, I mean, she's never acted before, and she's brilliant, and I can't take much credit for that. She's just, she has this integrity and strength and pride in a way. And she's very tough, but the hard work was that there are two scenes where one of them is crying. And they told me when I asked if they wanted to be in the film after doing a lot of auditioning, they were 11 and 16 at that point, and they told me, I can be in this film if you want to, but I can't cry. So if you want that, you have to find someone else. Yeah.
And what did you say to that?
Oh, I thought, I mean, there are no people who cannot cry. So I thought we had to figure that out, and then I told them, you know, this is film, so we can fake it. We can put something in your eyes. And when they were both like, we don't do fake. If it hurts, it should hurt.
What's the there's the old Hollywood story about Margaret O'Brien was one of the famous child stars, and they literally told her that her dog had died to get her to cry on scene, and that was what they would do to get somebody. So I envision you like you know going up to get the tears to tell them that you know the reindeer died or something.
Well, how did you know that?
I know how a director thinks.
Yeah, well, sometimes you're this like evil therapist. But I mean, they wanted it to be real, so we had to do it.
Okay, now oftentimes we shoot a film, a filmmaker will shoot a film, and they will get into the editing bay, they'll be in the editing process, and they have to try to figure out the story that they thought they had told, but when they see the footage, they're going, I don't know. And I'm wondering, you know, you use a classic framing device, which is, you know, someone looking back on their lives and how it got to them to that point. Was that what you originally intended? Because I think it worked very, very well. But I was curious as I was watching it, was going, what did we mean to actually frame the entire thing from front to, you know, back like that? Or was it going to be something different?
It wasn't the script all the way. Actually, the book ends was its own short, and it was here at Sundance 2 years ago. It's called Northern Great Mountain. So we shot that as a pilot, and we were so fortunate it could come here and premiered here at Sundance. And that was already a part of the feature film script. And we got the funding while we were here 2 years ago.
Wow.
For the feature. And now it's here. Yeah. So it's kind of full circle.
That is the way Sundance is supposed to work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, the film is Sammy Blood. It screens in the Spotlight section. And we've been talking to the director, Amanda Chanel. Amanda, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
And we're back on the Daily Buzz here on KCPW and KCPW.org. Again, my name is John Wildman from Festworks.com. And right now we're talking to Laura Dunn. She's the director, one of the directors of Look and See, A Portrait of Wendell Berry. This film is, I'll let the director give us the really quick description of what Look and See is about.
Okay, Wendell Berry is a writer and a farmer from rural Kentucky. He's written over 50 different books, poetry, fiction, nonfiction. He's one of our greatest living writers. And it's a portrait of him. It's an unconventional portrait because he's an unconventional person. And the way I say it is that it's really a portrait of the world as he sees it rather than the way the world sees him.
Well, you know, and I will say to your very great credit, it's not just a portrait of Wendell Berry, but it goes into the thing that he immersed himself in, which was agriculture, and I'll separate that to agra and then culture, because that was, you know, so much about his writing, and almost a systematic destruction of a lifestyle and a way of life through the mechanization of farming during the 70s with Earl Butz under the direction of Richard Nixon's administration. And I'm very curious, as a director and editing this, you know, oftentimes, you know, when you're editing, I hear from documentary filmmakers, when we're editing documentaries, we're finding the story in the editing room. So was that your original intention? Was it going to be more of a straightforward, this is Wendell Berry, or did what was in him fuse itself into the film?
Yeah, in many ways, I think Wendell Berry was my director. I really wanted to make a film that reflected who he is and his essence, because his writing and his words have been so important to me personally. So to try to understand that, understand what he sees, how he sees it. So yes, I mean, if metaphorically I sort of gave him the camera and let me point it at the things he holds dearest and the things he values. And for Wendell, you know, he's not a real advocate of film per se. He's anti-screen of all kinds. So it really had to become a tool that would be practically used to help the people he cares about and advance the issues he writes so beautifully about. And he lives in rural Henry County, Kentucky. It's largely a farming community. And the things, if you read all of his works, the themes that really weave throughout all of his writings are membership, community, and land stewardship. And so the portrait, in a sense, is an ethnographic portrait of his place. And there you will find lots of small family farmers, generational family farmers. And yeah, you're tapping onto the industrialization of agriculture and how that has changed our relationship to the land and how it really has pushed a lot of farmers off the land and has disenfranchised a lot of people in rural communities. And so Wendell writes about that from a lot of different perspectives.
And what's fascinating is how gentle he is as he delivers that message. You know, because, you know, in others' hands, you could see how someone would be a firebrand about that process, because so many people, you know, lost their lives, lost their livelihoods through the corporatization of farming. I mean, you know, I am someone that my first job in Indiana was detasseling corn when I was, you know, a 13-year-old, you know, which is part of that, you know, through part of that process. And here's the other thing that I loved about the film is that the hope that Wendell Berry has, the film reflects that hope, that, you know, it's not just, you know, a doomsday, you know, thing, you know, family farming as we know is dead, but there's actually at a point where you're kind of feeling low in the film, then it kind of sweeps up and through not just his writings, but also the interviews that you did with the farmer that went into organic farming and the success that he had. I found that wonderful. And I'm wondering again, you know, was that a happy discovery to you?
Yes. I mean, I think you're hitting on something important. I asked Wendell once, sort of, if you do the math, correct? If you look at the math in terms of anything with the environment these days, it can feel quite despairing. The numbers aren't all too encouraging. If you want to talk about climate or global warming, if you want to talk about farmers sustaining good land stewardship in rural communities, these are things that are under assault. And you can sometimes feel overwhelmed by the numbers. But I asked Wendell about that. How do you find hope? And he said simply, hope's a virtue. You've got to have it. And I think he's very interested in cultivating hope and that's important. And so, yes, he, you know, he's gentle sometimes because he's a poet, but he can be quite serrated when he really tells you what's going on. And I think there's something important there, is that let's sober up, let's look truly at what's going on, and then let's move through that, try to transcend that, and cultivate and build on places where there are signs of hope. And I think that one thing that's important is that art is a way that can be kind of transcendent, where we can look beyond the literal and start to think in a bigger frame, and it can challenge our imagination, not only see what's here, but also to imagine what's possible. And I think Wendell's artfulness and the way he looks at the world encourages that.
Well, yeah, yes, and I have the image of the velvet glove, you know, they say, you know, delivering that message. Let's also talk about the style of the film. Using the wood carving imagery and the etchings and which I thought again puts us in a very proper place for hearing this message. Can you talk about how you came to that idea?
I did not. My husband, Jeff Sewell, who's the co-director of the film and did a lot of the visual design, said, you know, look at these books. A lot of Wendell's books are printed by a man named Gray Zeitz at Larkspur Press. It's a local press in Kentucky. They're letter press. This is the old way. It's the analog way, in a sense, not the digital way. It's slower. It's more handcrafted. That's the aesthetic and the value that you can see move through all of Wendell's world and his work. And there is a man named Wesley Bates, who's based out of Toronto, who's one of our preeminent woodcut artists, engraving artists. These images are often used in a lot of Wendell's books. And Jeff said, let's try to find Wesley. Let's see if we can commission him to do some original work for the film so that the film itself will visually sort of put you in the world of a Wendell Berry book. And so we worked with Wesley. Jeff and Wesley worked very closely together to illustrate the ideas. And at the end of the film, you'll see there's a whole series. And it's this idea, again, I think you have the digital world, and then you have the analog world, a world that is slower pace. It's an alternative to our ever-increasing speed. There's an artfulness there. And that's the theme we're trying to get out with really everything we did in the film.
So Jeff earned his keep on that one.
Sure did.
All right, and this film was, am I correct that this film was kind of developed through the Sundance Labs or something? Am I correct with that?
Yeah, our first funding came from the Sundance Institute Documentary Film Program, and we were a part of that. They funded it at different stages, and then we were a Sundance Fellow at the festival a few years ago. So yes, they've been instrumental.
Well, again, knowing the struggles that, you know, that documentarians go through, I represented a film once that took the woman 13 years to do the film. She had two kids in between the time she started and ended. Can you talk about how much of a relief was it that you were kind of, you know, under that umbrella and you had that support?
Oh, I think it's key. I mean, there's so many films being made, being tried to be made. And I think once Sundance says this is a worthwhile project, it really helps you gather more partners and more support. So it was absolutely key right from the beginning.
Awesome. And then the last question I wanted to ask you is because oftentimes with documentaries now, you know, we have issue documentaries, and this, you know, falls into that environmental category. You know, but again, it's a kinder, gentler way, the Velvet Fist of putting your message across. Can you talk about, you know, presenting a film like this, you know, again, in, you know, in that arena for, you know, for audiences to kind of relax into it?
I think sometimes you make the film that you want to see. I think that I see a lot of films, and a lot of them make me sad or make me feel depressed or make me feel overloaded with yet more information. And I think that, you know, I have six kids, and I think a lot about the world that I want them to be in. So I'm not as drawn to toxic waste sites as much as I want to show a world that's beautiful, that's still preserved, to show the possibilities of something whole and healthful. So I think that I wanted to make a film that reflected that in that world and brought you into it and showed you what's at stake if we lose it all together.
So we've been talking with Laura Dunn. She's the director and editor of one of the directors with her husband Jeff of the documentary Look and See, A Portrait of Wendell Berry. It would be a wonderful accomplishment just in the fact that she's able to make a film and have six kids, but it's also an amazing film on top of that. She's got to go off to a premiere. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And we are back on The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman from Festworks.com. I'm joined, co-hosting this with me will be Minji Chang from Collaboration. And right now we're talking about a film that I have been itching to talk about since I saw it. The film is Motherland. It's in the World Cinema Documentary section. We have with us the director, Ramona S. Diaz. Ramona, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Okay. I'd like to let the director introduce the film quickly before we dive into it. Tell us what Motherland is about.
Motherland is a film about one of the busiest maternity hospitals in the world, and it happens to be in the Philippines. It's called the Jose Fabella Memorial Hospital. And the film takes place in the hospital and the goings on in the hospital. And we follow like three patients, three mothers, as they're as they come into the hospital and are discharged like 3-4 weeks later.
Yes, it is a hospital packed from, it's almost like a women on a conveyor belt. It's an amazingly frightening view, it was to me, of all these women that are there. They're giving birth. They're with their babies. Many of them with preemies, that with babies that children that have been born early. And because of the financial situation of that you know, they don't have the incubators. They have what is it kangaroo?
Kangaroo,
yeah.
See?
Yes.
Kangaroo mother care.
Kangaroo mother care.
Yeah.
And can you explain what kangaroo mother care is?
Kangaroo mother care is, a lot of the women, I mean, you realize this is a public hospital. So it is really a lot of impoverished women go there to give birth. And because it's a public hospital, they have no resources to have a nursery or incubators. So what they've done, and I think this is, it originated in South America somewhere. It's called kangaroo mother care. So they take all their preemies on their chests, and they hold them there with a tube.
With a tube top.
Tube top, exactly.
They put them in the tube.
Yeah, yes. It's a very nice-looking tube top, actually. Right, so it's fashionable tube top. And they put their infants on their chests, and they're supposed to leave them there for 24 hours, 24/7. So unless they're, taking a shower or whatever, the babies are on their chest for the warmth. So basically, what happens is the mothers serve as human incubators. And everyone is welcome to do that. I mean, everyone within the family, husbands, mothers.
Right, yeah, the husbands will come by and they'll do the same thing.
And it's a bonding activity between the parents or whoever the caregiver is.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just ask, Ramona, I was so drawn in from the first moment. There's so much.
Thank you.
It's a sensory overload of the emotion and the physical duress that these women are going through, obviously going through labor. How is that
How did that story come about? I mean, you had three women, but it seems like there are several women that
yeah.
you get to know throughout
yeah.
this film.
Yeah. My idea was to, look, I visited the hospital because I was researching another film that had to also do with reproductive justice and reproductive health and maternity rights, right? So in the process of researching, I visited Fabelia, and just like you, I was so taken by just the experience of being there. It's overwhelming. And the idea for me, my idea was to just drop the audience into that space, right? And sort of figure out what the space is like. And then, you know, then the film focuses obviously on the three or four women, but you know, women come and go. So some of the women will come and go because if you give birth to like a normal healthy baby, you're in and out in 24 hours. So the women I followed gave birth to preemies because I wanted to follow them over time. So over a month. So that should be the experience of the audience. But I think it's organized chaos. So even if it is chaotic, it works on a lot of levels. And I think what really drew me to the hospital was the communities of women that formed around this very intimate
to kind of protect each other
space.
Yeah. Through
exactly.
that process.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I found to me there are two sides. One, you're the fact that like is always, you know, mother, mommy, you know, mommy's in the shower, mommy, and so there's an impersonal. There's everyone's just a number, and everybody's mother and everybody's mommy. And yet, when the sit down moments where they're trying to do family planning,
right,
and they're trying to encourage them to use IUDs or whatever, and they're fighting against it, even though they've had five or six or seven, you know, kids already, and their only reasoning for it, well, my mommy told me not to.
Because they're very young, you know, a lot
yes.
of very young mothers.
And just scared,
yeah.
too, personally. I mean,
yeah.
that narrative was very moving for me as a young woman, and to have been privileged to live in the United States and
right.
have access to certain kinds of health care or education.
Yeah, education.
Right, and so...
And misinformation about IUDs.
Right.
Because, you know, a lot of them think it's this foreign object in their body, it'll cause cancer.
Right.
Right, there's all this misinformation around that. So really, the key is education. And that's what... The film that I was researching, it was actually about the reproductive health bill. And one of the key issues in the bill was, one of the main points was education. So that's key. And misinformation and education. I mean, these are very young mothers, and even the older mothers, right? And that comes also, it's a very Catholic country. So, and the Catholic church has a lot of influence over women. So it's cultural, it's social, it's political.
I'm always curious when I talk to directors that do a documentary like this, how tempting it is to offer some assistance. To,
yeah.
You know, and I could only imagine with some of these the women that were featured in this, you know, how tough it would be, like, you know, to see the, you know, the boyfriends, you know, come in that, you know, that aren't working, and to just sit there with your camera and just watch it.
It's very tough, you know, but I think as in my other films, you really have to define what your role is in the space. You're there as filmmaker, you're observer, and there's a line I think you don't cross, because the minute you cross that line, then it's over, right? Then your role, and it gets confusing. And I didn't want to, like, help them, and then they'll feel beholden then to perform for me, and, you know, in some fashion. Yeah, but it is tough. It is tough. And there's always this ethical problem, right? You are telling their stories. You want to put it out in the world. But at the end of the day, they're very impoverished women. So what do you do? Who is it really for, right? So, you know, those are ethical questions you always ask yourself as a documentary filmmaker constantly. Yeah.
I'm very curious as to what the process was like to get these women to agree. I mean, it's just so
to open up
personal,
to you.
Right. You know, to let you be there for 4 weeks and follow their whole journey and be part of a very intimate healing
right.
process and everything. How did that go?
You know, we were just there constantly. We were there. You know, Fabelia has been covered in the press before. So photographers would come in, or cameras would come in. They'd come in for like 2 hours, right? They'd helicopter in, and they'd be gone, right? We were there constantly for the month, like 24/7. So they couldn't quite believe it's like you're still here, We're like, yeah, we just want to know. What do you want to know today? I said, whatever you tell us. It's your life. We're not going to get in your way. We're just going to be here. And the fact that we were there every day, and we wanted to know about them, I think that you develop a trust and respect. And also, way before we filmed, I was actually at the hospital every day for like a month, because I needed to figure out the goings on in the hospital and who was, it's a community. It's a tribe, right? You need to know what the hierarchy is, who the tribal elders are, and get them on your side, really, and tell them, try to really explain what it is you're doing.
Well, we've been talking about the film Motherland, which screens in the World Cinema Documentary section here at the Sundance Film Festival. We've been speaking with the director, Ramona S. Diaz. Again, if you have a chance to see this movie, it will open your eyes in a lot of different ways. Again, my name is John Wildman. Thank you to Minji Cheng of Collaboration for co-hosting this segment. Thank you again, Ramona.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ramona.
Thanks.
We are back on the Daily Buzz from Park City, Utah, on the Sundance Film Festival. My name is John Wildman from Festworks.com. I'm joined by my co-host, Kim Voyner of Wonder Tech Labs. And right now we're going to talk about the film Dina, which plays in the U.S. documentary competition here at Sundance. We have the co-directors of the films, Dan Sickles and Antonio Santini, here. And we have the subjects of the film, Dina Buono, and Scott Levin, her husband, is here. This is very exciting for me. Let's start off with our directors. Dan and Antonio, how did you find Dina, and how did you convince her and Scott to let them be photographed and talk about them on the film?
Well, I've known Dina all of my life, basically. My dad was one of her teachers when she was in high school, and they had like a really close relationship. He was like a kind of a father figure to her and a confidant. So Dina's always been a part of my life, and she's known me before I was autonomous, while I was in the womb. And I've just always known about her and her story and kind of, about her experiences. And Antonio and I were finishing up work on the first film, and Dina was around and in our lives, and we kind of started talking about it, and one thing led to another, and I found out that Dina was getting engaged to Scott, and that's like when the idea for the film really started to take shape.
All right, and Antonio, why don't you introduce our audience quickly, because they have not seen the film yet, likely, to Dina and Scott, and and why they made wonderful subjects for a film.
Well, originally, when we started talking about making the movie, we were going to cover the entire Action Club, which is the club that Dina and Scott belong to, which is headed by Darlene, who's also here with us. And what happened was that when we started filming, Dina kind of just stole the show. We don't know what it was, but she just kind of just stood out, and we realized that we just wanted to focus it on her. And Dan and her talked, and Dan found out that she was getting married to Scott, and we realized that, that we had this whole thing to follow, and a lot of stuff happened in between those moments that we were really interested in, all those, like, almost secret moments that other people don't get to watch, and we got really into those, and we felt really privileged that Dina and Scott let us in to observe those.
Dina, there was a lot of intimate moments in the film, intimate, like close-in personal moments with you and Scott. How was it for the two of you as you were navigating getting married to have cameras in your face while you were talking about sex and other kinds of personal issues?
Well, I'm very open, as you can see. I love the camera. I always did. I always loved stage and film
and acting,
and I have a little bit of a background since high school and childhood, and I watched Dan through his acting career and was very proud of him, and most of the time it was absolutely wonderful. And being autistic, when something would trigger anxiety, that was the only problem that I had with the camera, was when, do you need to shut it off right now? So should I tell people my real story. And you know what? I really didn't care because I wanted people to know the real Dina and the real me. I didn't want to hide anything. So basically, I had absolutely no problem with these cameras coming around 24/7.
So you chose to just kind of breathe through those moments of anxiety and let the camera stay focused and be real.
Right. Well, I wanted to tell the real world, the inside world of an autistic woman, and not tell any lies. This was the real me. And one day it was going to be out in a book anyway, so I thought, what better chance to do this in a movie?
And Scott, you're also navigating, you know, this thing as well. Can you talk about from your perspective, having the cameras there and you know, going through these moments that were captured, and yet it's not just the two of you, it's not just you and Dina. There are also some cameras there. They're right there with you.
Well, I will admit that some of these moments were kind of awkward because I'm not as familiar with the camera as my lovely wife is. But I was able to muddle through it, get through the film, and all the wonderful things that we did and stuff like that. And I think it's a wonderful story, and hopefully they'll love it.
It was wonderful, and we also, you know, get to enjoy your singing voice as well.
That's correct in
this film, which is very nice.
Yeah.
Scott is like a walking radio.
Yeah.
Like
basically,
you can request any genre or any artist or even any album, and Scott can basically deliver.
That's right.
it's a really good skill to have.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in the film is our wedding scene where I'm singing our wedding song as we're dancing. That's one of my favorites.
I love that scene.
I like when I was very upset, I had gotten a bad phone call from somebody.
Same song, too. Oh, yeah. She's right.
Yes.
There was a scene. I had gotten a very bad phone call one day.
When he holds up the phone and says, here, I'm going to play this for you?
Right.
I cried. Exactly right. I cried on that scene.
I think it was.
Whoa.
I did. I was watching
that?
I did.
It was so that one scene.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. The one scene that I'm talking about. Scott did a beautiful moment where they were filming, and I had the gang was over at my house, and I had a bad day. Everything was going wrong, and I got a bad phone call from somebody, and I broke down in tears. And Scott said, I have a surprise for you, when he sang our wedding song. It was a favorite song back in the 80s, I'll Be Right Here Waiting, and Scott sang the song.
That's right.
And Dina, then again at the wedding, too.
There are some people that you're excited to see this week, right?
Yes.
Who are you most excited to see?
Well, I'm excited to see Treat Williams, who actually lives here in Park City, Utah. And I'm hoping to see Adam Brody from The O.C. If there was a Lifetime
it's a
movie.
Crush.
It's been... Oh,
Adam Brody, are you listening?
So if you're listening to this.
I've loved him since growing up Brady. I was a teenage Greg, which was my favorite show growing up. And he played Barry Williams' character. And also The O.C., he was the lead character, Seth Cohen. A Fox channel. And Adam Brody reminds me a lot in the beginning of The O.C., kind of like an autistic, eccentric man. He reminds me so much of Scott. That's who I want him to play in the movie.
So Adam Brody, you're going to play the fictionalized version of Scott in the fictionalization
yes.
of the Dina story.
I'm hoping that...
Heads Adam up. Brody plays me. Who plays you, sweetheart?
Molly Ringwald.
Oh,
yes. I would like Molly Ringwald. Well, I kind of have her haircut now.
Yes.
But there were some shows that she was in with long hair, and I think extensions and makeup can. I think that we can probably work with the.
We could maybe make Molly look as good as you. They'd have
yeah,
to try.
Yeah. Molly Ringwald was the teen queen of the '80s and The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles, and I love her. And it would be good. Yeah, it would
be
really
a good
awesome.
Fit,
yeah,
for sure.
Dan, you know, of course, you've known Dina forever, and you know, and so there's a different kind of connection there as a director and a subject. Can you talk about the framing of the film? Obviously, because there's a wedding coming up, that kind of lends itself toward, well, we're leading up to a wedding, and the wedding happens, and I've got the ending to my film. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. Can you talk about that part of it?
Definitely. I mean,
you know, the film is unscripted, you know, so we didn't, there was no way of perceiving how the event would turn out, how the relationship would turn out, you know. I mean, like, it's important to remember that, like, their relationship is still evolving until today. It's like, they're not static characters that exist in an ordinary narrative film, you know. And these are their first moments, really, together and coming together and inching towards each other, and that's what really what we tried to capture. But yeah, I mean, like, it's like, you know, being with Dina and spending so much time with her, it's making the film has been like a very personal experience for me. Spending a lot of time with somebody who I've known for forever, who, you know, I think reminds me a lot of my dad and
right.
You know, and his legacy and kind of all the richness that he left behind yeah. when he passed.
I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that in August 17th of 2013, you know, we lost Ed. You know, sorry here.
But he was important. He was, you know, he's very important to you.
I hope that they don't mind that I'm a little choked up. I didn't expect this, you know. Ed was my father figure. Unfortunately, I love my father dearly, but Ed was there for me at every moment. I called him up when I had troubles. And Dan is my connection to Ed. And I watched this young man emerge. I went to his school place. And, you know, I'm sorry for getting so emotional.
Yes, it's fine.
You know, Ed used to tell me, you're going to be okay. And even today when I'm coping with things, what would Ed be doing? You know, and I try to make things light for Dan because it's a loss for him too. But having Dan in my life has been the biggest. It's helped me heal my pain because, you know, Ed was the person I called every other day. And he called me every other day.
And we've got to spend a lot of time together.
And we had to spend a lot of time together. Even when Dan was a young boy, I saw a lot of his father in him. His father was a busy man with teaching and an advocate. And I remember calling and asking, I said, hi, Dan, is your dad there? And he was a teenager. And he said, well, you can talk to me. And that was something, this was this young boy who was 14 years old who had homework and friends and play rehearsal, but he took the time. The message always got to him.
Well, it's amazing for anyone
yeah.
to be able to be at the Sundance Film Festival with a film. It's twice as amazing for that film to be about you and for you as well to be able to go through this experience with Dan and for you guys to be able to take all of this in together, which is really a celebration of you and Scott. I watched the film. I love the film. I'm happy for you guys. Thank you for being here. Again, the film is Dina. We've had the directors, Dan Sickles and Antonio Santini here, and of course, Dina Buono and Scott Levin. Enjoy Sundance, guys.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
And we're wrapping up day one of the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. My name is John Wildman, with Kim Voyner, Minji Chang, and Lanzia Wan. The show is made possible with the support of KCPW and our sponsors, Rise Media and Skull Candy. Additional support is provided by Chef Dance, Pop Art Snacks, Park City Roasters, the Big O Donuts, and the Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.